Hello, you're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My name's Craig Barker, and I'm the head of public engagement at the museum at the University of Sydney. Welcome to Object Matters. This podcast explores the relationship between our guests and a museum collection item. And for this particular episode, I'm especially thrilled to be joined by Dr. Tona Stevenson. Tona is the head of the School of Humanities here in the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at the university, and also an affiliate in the discipline of history as well. Tona is also the co-author of the recent book, Eclipse Chasers, published now through CSIRO Publishing. Welcome, Tona. Thank you very much for joining us on Object Matters.
Thank you, Craig. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can I begin by asking you about your role at the University of Sydney, and particularly focusing on your role as school manager at FAS? What does that job involve?
Well, I'm the manager of one of six schools, and our school encompasses seven disciplines, of which history is one, linguistics,
yep.
Archaeology, the classical languages, ancient history, gender and cultural studies, philosophy, and studies in religion. We've also got foundations and centres in archaeology and linguistics. It's quite a complex role because my team provides support so that the academics can go and do their teaching, can do their research. We help support them getting grants. We help them with teaching technologies, with understanding how to, if they want to go on a conference overseas, how to go about doing that. That's important. And we also manage the budget, the finances for the school. Very important. And our school was once only five disciplines, and it's just fantastic to have linguistics and studies in religion join us, which is very new, only the last 6 months.
And you're finding a lot of interdisciplinary approaches now because there are those connections that didn't exist before?
Absolutely. You know, the thing is that people can have great ambitions to get together and do things, but when you're just down the hall, it's so much easier. And that's the beauty of it, is bringing everyone. This is a year of consolidation for us, because also archaeology were over in a demountable village. And, you know, that was not fantastic, but they did okay. But this year we're bringing them back into the quadrangle.
Yeah.
And I believe that's where archaeology was first taught, at the University of Sydney.
75 years ago, the week we're recording this. How's that for a factoid? But, I mean, interestingly, because, Tona, it's, although you're based within faculty, I see you at the museum all the time. How do you engage with the Chow Chak Wing Museum through that capacity as head of school?
Well, our academics have been absolutely relishing in the opportunities that the Chow Chak Wing Museum provides, especially for teaching the students. Yes, sure, before you had the Nicholson Museum, but now in Chow Chak Wing, you've got those dedicated teaching spaces. You've got a staff member or two staff members who can bring out objects to, for example, in history, support teaching about migration or about commerce. In fact, the collections here touch all of the humanities. So we're absolutely delighted and amazed at how much we can engage with Chow Chak Wing. The other thing is, of course, our events.
Yes.
And it's wonderful for the students to receive their awards and their families to come to Chow Chak Wing Museum for that, because it's more than going to a venue. It's actually having a whole experience and getting a sense of the historical collections, but also the contemporary nature of the university, which the Chow Chak Wing Museum provides.
As well as your position with FAS, you are also an honorary associate with the discipline of history, and you have a doctorate of social sciences and museology. Could you tell us about your research interests? Because you seem to have been interested in a whole lot of different things throughout your career.
Oh, yes, that's one of my failures. But I enjoy it because I love the sciences and I love the arts, and I'm absolutely passionate about museums and their collections. You know, I've been visiting museums. I remember You know, one of the first times I went when I was 8 years old, and I came home and I sketched a lot of the statues that I'd seen at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. I think my parents were a little bit horrified because they were all in the nude.
Yeah.
but I have to look very closely, and I love to see how objects are interpreted and what these collections can tell us, not only about the past, but today.
Yeah.
You know, how we might look at them today, that's a bit different to how they were collected, perhaps, and how they were interpreted in the past. And I guess my research has somehow translated into focusing on some of the lesser valued collections. My thesis was about the astrographic catalogue, or the Great Star Catalogue, that involved 22 observatories all around the globe, began in 1887, and produced a lot of, in fact, tens of thousands of glass plate negatives.
Yes.
And these glass plate negatives had sort of been almost forgotten.
Yeah.
And so my job was to go and find out about them and look at them really closely. And that's what I enjoyed doing, and looking at the logbooks are being kept. And so lo and behold, you find that although you know all about the men who were the lead astronomers, when you look up in a logbook, the initials MEG, and this was in one of the earliest logbooks, 1890, for this particular project. MEG, Mary Emma Graham. Yes, one of the first women involved in the project in Australia, in Adelaide.
Yeah.
And then you look at the timesheets. Oh, she was working at 9 o'clock at night. Why was she working at night? And it was in winter. Sky would have been dark. Then you look at the telescope recording books. Oh, she was observing.
Yeah.
How amazing. This woman who nobody knows about did this.
An integral part of the process.
And over 1,000 stars, reference stars, that were used by the other three observatories that ended up finishing the catalogue.
Wow. Yeah. And what she'd been forgotten about otherwise.
Totally. She's not really on the records until I found them, really. But not that, and now there's a plaque to her.
Oh, fantastic.
Where Adelaide Observatory once stood. It's now a school.
Yes.
And an archaeologist who was doing work there found the base of the telescope that she used. And he said, oh, let's put a plaque there to her.
Oh, fantastic.
So that
real practical aspect of history, that you are shining a light on something that has been forgotten within sort of the mainstream narrative of science history in this case, but history more generally, must be quite an exciting part of the process of seeing that end result of that story being shared much more widely.
Totally. It's absolutely, I always feel honored when I think about the fact that other people have picked up on the story and that they've come up with ideas themselves. You know, I've done a work with the Biennale, an artist who was working at Sydney Observatory and producing an online digital artwork, and she asked me to be part of that.
Yes.
And, various other people.
So, of course, over the past decades, you've also been very heavily involved within the museum sector in Sydney. Where are some of the places you've been working?
Well, I started working at the Museum of Applied Arts and Sciences, which became the Powerhouse Museum, and I was a designer there. So I was one of the designers that worked on the initial Powerhouse when it opened in 1988.
Yeah.
And that year I also got another job there, and that was organising the exhibitions program. And I kind of got that surreptitiously because I was designing an exhibition and someone had to go to Bangkok, and it was a travelling exhibition, and make sure that the exhibition got from Bangkok to Sydney and was packed correctly and all of that. So I ended up doing that as well as designing the exhibition. and we were chatting away and I said, well, actually, we probably need someone to do that kind of work. And my boss then said, well, I've been thinking that too. And so between the two of us, we started up an exhibitions coordination or project management.
Yeah.
And then that became my career. So I stopped designing, became a project manager. And one of the great projects that I loved doing was project managing a change at Sydney Observatory, which was about bringing the collections home. Sydney Observatory had been acquired by the Powerhouse in 1982, and a lot of the collections had been removed to kind of make it a more of a sciencey centre. And then the decision was made in 1997 to bring back the essence of the observatory, the story of astronomy in Australia. And I was absolutely fortunate to be involved in that. I ended up becoming manager of Sydney Observatory, which was a dream job.
For our listeners outside of Sydney, could you just briefly describe the observatory at Sydney and why it's so important?
It's so important. Sydney Observatory opened in 1857, and it sits on top of Observatory Hill, which is right next to the Harbour Bridge. Now, this was once the highest natural point in Sydney. So it's in a very obvious place. And in 1857, everyone around could see the observatory. It had a time ball on top of the tower. And that was the real reason it was built, because ships in the harbour had to set their chronometers to accurate time. So many ships got lost at sea because they didn't know where they were. And knowing the time meant you could calculate where you were on the planet. So that was very important. And Sydney Observatory went on to become very important astronomically, as I mentioned before, the Great Star Catalogue, which was one of the first internationally organised science projects. It had its centre in Paris, was very prestigious, and Sydney Observatory was part of the British contingent. And it then went on to do other work. Harley Wood was one of the well-known astronomers there, and he was part of the instigation of the Astronomical Society of Australia, which is now the peak body for all astronomers. So there's an incredible legacy that's been left by Sydney Observatory, and it's very exciting because it's just reopened after 2 years of closure because to do urgent maintenance work. And they've actually gone another step further, as I understand, in reinstating the history by bringing back some of the furniture and the stories of how the observatory was used.
So, Tony, what came first then? Your interest in astronomy or working at the observatory, or was it sort of an organic relationship?
It was a little bit organic because I remember in 1976 as a schoolgirl, going outside, I knew there was a partial solar eclipse in Sydney, and it was pretty cloudy, but there was a little bit of sun coming through and doing a little bit of a projection of that partial solar eclipse in my backyard in Sydney. And then one of the joys of my life at the Powerhouse was working on the Leonardo da Vinci Codex Leicester, which was owned by Bill Gates. And this was the year that Sydney had the Olympics. So we had this amazing exhibition of Greek treasures. And we also had an amazing collection of this Leonardo's Codex. And I was so closely involved. You know, I got to see the original pages. And seeing those drawings really brought it home to me how intrinsic astronomy and our place on this planet, now planet's relationship to everything else, how important that is to humanity. So that was really important. And then the job came up at Sydney Observatory. So, of course, I said, I put my hand up for it. But I'd also got involved in citizen astronomy because Sydney Observatory was also the heart of an astronomy group that had begun in 1895 and involved men and women. And did amateur astronomy. So I'm still involved with this group and we have a talks program and we go and do observing. And it just means that I get a lot of hands-on with telescopes because I was not really coached or taught how to use a telescope. except by my colleagues.
At
Sydney Observatory, and also the other amateur astronomers. Mm. So this is a joyous voluntary and fun occupation.
Well, look, I mean, you've only just very, very recently launched your book, co-authored with Nick Lom, called Eclipse Chasers. Can you tell us what drove you, A, to write about solar eclipses, but talk a little bit about the book?
Well, the book is very uniquely Australian. And the inspiration for the book, for me, came from when I was looking through the Powerhouse archive, the photographs that related to Sydney Observatory. And I came across a photograph of an Einstein house on the race course at Gundawindi. Now, the only thing I knew about the Gundawindi race course was the Gundawindi Grey, far left,
yes,
of course. Yes. So I thought, now this is a little bit unusual. Yeah. And I went and spoke with Dr. Nick Lom, who was the curator of astronomy, and he told me the story of how Sydney Observatory was involved in going to Gundawindi Racecourse to prove Einstein's theory of general relativity.
Uh-huh.
So I immediately, my little physics antennas went up. Yeah. I was always very keen on physics.
Yes.
And I thought, now that must be an interesting story. And I looked more closely at those photographs. And this is an era, 1922.
Yes.
When there's horses that on drays that carry instruments to the train.
Yeah,
and then they
yeah.
got on the yes. train, they went to Gundawindi, they had yes. everything.
These precision equipment that are
being jostled around. Yeah. And I mentioned the Great Star Catalogue, and they had to use this really heavy telescope from that project in this very fine, very delicate operation to photograph the stars so precisely to try and convince people that the 1919 proof of Einstein's theory was in fact repeatable. Mm. And as you know, that's so important in science.
Yeah.
It has to be repeatable at another time, another location.
So why there? Why the racetrack in particular?
Well, the racetrack happened to be on the perfect path of totality.
Oh, wow.
And so the more I looked into this, I started to see it was not the only expedition.
Yep.
In fact, Lick Observatory from California had on the other side of Australia and Western Australia set up a camp with astronomers from many parts of the globe, and they were being helped by the local First Nations Nyangamata Waran people in actually making the camp work and the right conditions to do this fine test of Einstein's theory.
Yeah.
It was very hot and dusty.
Yes.
So the Aboriginal people bought water and they wet these great white sheets that they had to keep things cool.
Yeah.
You know, they knew that the wind would come up as it does, just before a totality starts.
Yeah.
And they were so important in preparing that site. And in fact, Lick Observatory were the ones that came up with the very convincing proof of Einstein's theory of general relativity.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, back on the other side of Australia, the path of totality went right across on Gundawindi Racecourse. Our fellow Sydney Observatory astronomer did not have such success.
Why was it failed or something?
Well, his instrument failed. The telescope.
That must be so frustrating.
It was. The telescope was too heavy for the driving mechanism.
Yeah.
They managed, though, to take some beautiful photographs, and they did other measurements, as you do.
Yes.
So this is an amazing story, and there was a series of stories, and Nick Lom said, well, I also have stories of other eclipse expeditions in Australia that I'm fascinated with.
Mm.
And we were off in 2012 to see a total solar eclipse in northern Australia up in Queensland.
Yeah.
And he said, well, we've been here before.
Yeah.
There was an expedition, you know, back in the late 1800s. Yeah. So, you know, so, well, when things start connecting,
yeah,
that's when, you know, you get sort of enthusiastic and curious. And that's what led to the book. And also at Sydney Observatory, we're very fortunate to be employing students from universities all over Sydney.
Yep.
And one of those students was Duane Hamasha. And Duane was starting to study with First Nations people Indigenous astronomy.
Yeah.
And that has become his career.
Yeah.
And yeah, through him, we got to get in contact with Uncle Giller, Michael Anderson, and Uncle Giller and Duane Hamasha worked very carefully,
yeah,
on the first chapter of the book. Yeah. And Duane then had been up to the Torres Strait. And so, you know, we've been thinking about this book for a very long time and gathering people together.
Yeah.
The other people involved, Jeffrey Wyatt was in charge of education, much the same as some of your role here, getting students. So he's a great communicator of astronomy.
Yeah.
And he likes to look forward. Melissa Holbert's an astrophotographer and organiser of tours.
Wide range of approaches.
Oh, and then Kirsten Banks, a very young astrophysicist, started working just as I was about to leave there. And she is an amazing science communicator and a Wiradjuri woman. And she said, well, I've not seen a total solar eclipse, but I can look at the science of it,
yeah,
and what might be interesting in some of the 5 eclipses coming up to look for.
Yeah.
And so together we seem to have a group of people with interesting but intersecting knowledges and interests.
So, of course, the whole aim of Object Matters, Tona, is to talk about at least one object from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection, and I know you've chosen an interesting one for us today. What object have you chosen for us?
I've chosen a silver coin that's a little smaller than 2 centimetres, so it's a reasonable size coin, a little bit bigger than a $1 coin in our currency, and it was struck in the Common Era, year 96.
So a lot older than a $1 Australian coin.
A lot older, and it's called the Denarius of Nerva. So it was struck in Rome, and it was struck to honour a new emperor. Now, his name was Nerva, but his real name was Marcus Coccius Nerva, and he came in at a difficult time.
Yes.
His predecessor had been murdered.
Yes.
And that is shown in this coin. He had many high offices in the Roman Empire, so he was loved by the Senate, but he had a bit of work to do with the army.
Yeah.
And on accession, he was named Imperator Nerva Caesar Augustus. And his crowning was September 96. And on one side of the coin, you see a side portrait of him.
So relatively standard, as you would expect in the first century AD of imperial coinage. It's the emperor's bust in profile, isn't it?
It is. And he has a laurel wreath on his head, which is a symbol of triumph. Again, fairly common.
Yeah.
But it's the other side that fascinated me. And I guess the first thing that struck me was the military standard, which is a bit of a stick with a circle on it.
Yes.
Now, what was that circle? I had my theories. I'm not an expert in this area, but I did some research, and it seems that the circle is commonly a symbol of the sun. The sun, the life giver.
Yes.
The sun is powerful.
Yeah.
So there were good reasons for that. At the very top of the sort of staff of the military standard is an eagle called in Roman times Aquila.
Mm.
And that's fairly standard as
well. Particularly for military as well.
Yes, yes. And then there's a ship's prow, which I think is this little half circle, you know, the powerful Roman navy. You know, they were proud of their ability to fight on sea.
And dominance of the Mediterranean.
Total dominance. So all this symbolized power. And then it's the words that go around it. Concordia exercitium. But it means agreement of the armies with the emperor. So here he is reaching out to the armies and saying, we're in agreement, you know, wanting peace. And that is reinforced by two hands clasping.
Yes.
Right. To reinforce that meaning. Now, what does that have to do with solar eclipses? Yes. Interestingly, when I looked at how the museum, Chow Chak Wing Museum, describes Nerva, there's a line that says, unfortunately, he died 2 years after he came to be emperor of a fever. He wasn't murdered like his predecessor.
Yes, rather unusually for a Roman emperor, yes.
Rather unusually.
Dying of natural causes.
Yes, yes. But they waited for his funeral to line it up with a solar eclipse.
Ah, right.
So I went looking. When were the solar eclipses? Now, NASA has done a marvellous job of recording not only the upcoming solar eclipses, but eclipses going back thousands of years. So I looked up 96 to 98. He died early 98. I couldn't find any total solar eclipses, but what I found was that in March 98, there was what is called an annular eclipse.
Right.
Now, that is where the moon doesn't quite cover the sun, and you're left with a circular ring.
Ah, yes, right, yes.
But it doesn't make the sky go completely dark, but it does have, there are changes.
Yes.
The temperature would drop a bit.
Yes.
The colour would change a little.
Yes.
The birds might stop chirping.
Yes.
Dogs and other animals running around, cows, would think, might be time to go to bed.
Yes,
so things would change. And that this would be a marvellous scenario for a funeral, in that it wouldn't go completely dark. And, you know, where they were in Rome wasn't on the sort of maximum path of totality.
Yeah.
But there would be an amazing change in the atmosphere.
Enough to be a recognisable effect of the eclipse.
And very moving.
Yeah.
A very moving. So, you know, in the end, Nerva must have been well regarded to have been given this very special funeral.
Mm.
And this also ties very much into the capability of the Romans.
Yep.
Their ability to predict eclipses was amazing. Yes. They'd inherited a lot of the maths of Greece
and Egypt.
That's why the coin was important to me.
Yeah.
And then I thought, I'm going to look up some other coins.
Yes.
Now, unfortunately, the Chow Chak Wing Museum does not have any Hadrian coins. And if someone wanted to donate one, that would be lovely, because Hadrian was the ultimate eclipse chaser.
Was he?
He was very fortunate in that a year after he became emperor in 117, in 118, there was the most magnificent total solar eclipse that
went right
over Rome.
Yeah.
6 minutes of totality.
Yeah.
And he was able to say, this is predicted.
Right.
So how powerful
yes.
was that for the population?
Well, yes, doesn't it? Yeah, doesn't it give you a real sense of, I'm in control of everything. I know what's going to happen. I can read nature.
Exactly.
I can read the skies.
I am the emperor of everything.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Chow Chak Wing Museum led me on to that.
Yeah, right.
Which I didn't know before. So anyone out there, if you've got a Hadrian coin with a total solar eclipse, and on the back of Hadrian's coin, some of them, you can see a total solar eclipse.
Right, so that was going to be my question, because, I mean, are there depictions of the eclipses on other Roman coins?
There are.
Were there coins minted specifically to mark Nerva's funeral?
Well, not that I know about Nerva, but I definitely know about Hadrian.
Fascinating.
And there's probably a lot more that I don't know. So there's some great research projects out there. Yeah. Lunar eclipses as well were more predictable and more regular.
Yeah.
And I suspect that they occur on coinage.
Fascinating. So the coin kind of then spun your research into different areas. Yeah.
Definitely. And then something really interesting happened last year. Last year was a century since 1922, since the final proof of Einstein's theory of general relativity. And guess what?
Yes, there was a coin minted to mark the occasion.
That's right.
By the Australian Mint
The Australian Mint, the Royal Mint in Perth, minted two beautiful coins.
Mm-hmm.
One is a $1 coin. It was never released.
Yeah,
so it's for collectors only. Yes, it's gold as $1 coins are.
Yep.
It's a flat coin, very beautiful though, and it shows...
You've brought it in.
I've brought it in. It shows the curvature of space diagrammatically. It's engraved on the coin, beautiful. Yes. But the very special coin is this one I'm holding in my hand, and it's a $5 coin, so a nice big coin, and it actually is curved.
Yes.
It's a beautiful concave coin to show how Einstein predicted that space was in four dimensions.
Right.
And that you can predict this during a total solar eclipse because the stars that you can photograph when the sun is blacked out will be impacted. The light from the stars will be impacted before it reaches our eyes and our cameras on Earth. By the forces, the gravity waves, the forces around the sun and curvature will occur. So those stars will be displaced from their correct and true locations.
Yes.
So if you took a photograph of those stars 3 months after or 3 months before and their positions in the sky and then compare that to what happens during an eclipse when those stars are actually behind the eclipsing sun, you'll see a very definite change in the positions of those stars relative to each other.
Yeah.
And here we have a coin that minted in Australia to commemorate that centenary.
Presumably Einstein himself was following the results of these missions quite closely because, you know, this is going to vindicate his theory. You know, was he receiving communication from the various researchers in Australia?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, in Wallal over in Western Australia where the Lick Observatory were, another person who wasn't one of the astronomy scientists was Charles Kingsford Smith.
Oh, really? Yes.
And he was ready to take results in the plane, in his over, you know, to get the communication lines going. Now, the absolute proof didn't happen till the following year when they'd been able to process all the data because they didn't want just a few stars, because that's what happened in 1919. There were only four or perhaps five stars that were able to demonstrate the theory.
Yeah.
In 1922, they had over 82 stars.
Yes, right.
So this was definitive. Absolutely convincing. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to make sure that several people went through the process of examining and computing the data. So it was an amazing feat. And I will just say this. What's really interesting is the head of physics now at the University of Sydney, Professor Tara Murphy, she's been working on the final proof of Einstein's theory of gravitational waves, which was proven, I think it was only last year, and the University of Sydney was part of that.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Extraordinary. So really we've kind of got, well, three coins, but two coins, but one from the first century AD, one from 2022, and again, sort of separated by time, separated by manufacturing, but connection is extraordinary. Do other coins throughout history feature eclipses? Where are eclipses depicted in human art and in human manufacture? Where are some of the places your research has led you to looking at, you know, paintings and illustrations and other forms of material culture?
Depictions of eclipses occur in all forms of culture. And one of the most fascinating things about the indigenous interpretation of eclipses is certainly in our country, in Australia, First Nations people have depicted eclipses in many, many cultural forms that show how observant what scientists they were.
Yes.
They didn't write down as Western astronomers did, but through the dance that goes back thousands of years, through their art forms, through the way they dressed for dance, the stories of the dreaming, it is becoming more and more obvious of how observationally based and connected this was right across Australia. This is not unusual, as in other countries we can see this as well.
Yes.
But it's fantastic to see this.
Yes. Yeah.
But today, 2012, you walk down the street in Port Douglas and there were banners. There was an art exhibition which featured artwork from the local Indigenous population. You could buy T-shirts with fantastic artworks on them. There were stamps minted.
We're great
at doing fantastic postage stamps.
Yes.
You know, in every possible form, musicians in the street singing solar eclipse songs.
Yeah.
You know, everyone knows Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Yes, yes.
You know, the sort of symbolism of solar eclipses occurs throughout. And, you know, there's many other ways that I see solar imagery in your collections here. I see it in the statues of Isis.
Yeah.
You know, where there's Isis,
yeah,
a female figure with a sun between the horns of the cow up above her head.
Yeah.
In the Egyptian symbolism,
yes,
of course, and, you know, right throughout our cultural history, the history of humanity, you can see the sun symbolized, not always in eclipse, but sometimes,
but certainly there,
it can be, and we're only sometimes recognizing that.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about that sort of on-the-street engagement with it, because bringing it back to the coin of Nerva, that Roman engagement and understanding of the power of nature and that religious aspect as well too, where it's been historically associated with divine spirits or movement or that broader understanding. But again, you know, bringing it back to your initial point about it being so evocative of our own human experience and that relationship with the natural world around us.
Yes, it's a little unfortunate though, because once you have experienced a total solar eclipse and the sort of shadow of the moon covering the sun exactly, and that ring, very fine ring around it, and seeing the corona of the sun and the diamond ring, you start to see it maybe in places. But it's not necessarily purposeful.
Yes.
So I'm saying that I start to see it in artworks.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, and when I look at artworks, I think, oh, maybe that would mean an eclipse. And then you read the label and it says something completely different. But it's so powerful that said, when you have that experience, that it does change your view of the world.
And I guess the association, and again, returning to the coin, but that association with the death of an emperor, so it's got remarkable symbolism and power, doesn't it?
It does, it does. And I think that one can see that the population would have been very impressed.
Yep.
You know, if they weren't in awe of the emperor beforehand,
yes,
but by the time his funeral occurred, they would have been.
The association of divinity with the Roman emperor too is clearly on display here.
Oh,
it's
yes,
very clever PR, isn't it? We tend to think of sort of politics and PR being a modern phenomenon, but the way that messaging was being manipulated within a Roman context in this case, but in other ancient cultures is extraordinary.
And I wonder if Nerva actually asked for that to, there to be some association, because when I was reading about him, one of his objectives was to change things so that he did lay a better path for emperors to come after him.
Yes.
So he was quite an extraordinary person. Well,
it's set off that the so-called era of the five good emperors as well, where you actually have a real sense of prosperity and peaceful transfer in Rome, unlike most of the history of the empire.
But he was one to be getting the sewers repaired and fixing up. He was a great believer in public works, and that would have been very helpful for future emperors as well. In 2 years, he seems to have accomplished a lot.
You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My guest for this episode is Dr. Tona Stevenson. Tona, the question I ask everyone who appears on the podcast, if you could choose one word in terms of what the coin and your broader research into solar eclipses, what the coin means to you and your connection to it, what would be that single word?
The word power.
Okay.
Came to my mind when you asked that question. Power, because of what we found out about the Roman emperors and how they used the connection with solar eclipses. Power, because of this powerful sense that you get when you're experiencing an eclipse, of what a perfect solar system we live in at the moment.
Yes.
You know, in hundreds of thousands of years' time, you won't be able to actually experience a solar eclipse. Humanity may not be around then, but we're very fortunate that the bodies of the sun and the moon perfectly fit each other and that they're both round.
Yes. Yes.
So there's a power in that.
Yeah.
A power in how the First Nations people of this country and other countries were very engaged in explaining phenomena such as total solar eclipses because they were powerful experiences that they wanted to pass on their knowledge about to future generations.
Yes.
So power.
Power. Fantastic. Now, the coin, unfortunately, is not on public display at the moment, although our listeners can view it through the Chow Chak Wing Museum's online collection search. But if it was ever displayed in an exhibition in future, what would you like visitors to think about if they stopped to see the coin?
I'd certainly like them to think about the coin as not just something to exchange. You know, the coins paid the soldiers of the Roman emperor. They were very important in Roman times. You know, the Romans set up the systems that we use today in economy. But to actually think of it as symbolic and symbolizing what became a very successful period for Emperor Nerva of the 2 years, and how important that period was in establishing
the century to come in terms of Roman history.
Totally. And how that impacted really all of the Western world. You know, when you get to Hadrian and others, you know the influence and how that sort of set things going for many things that we know are very common today.
Yeah.
So I'd like them to really look carefully at the coin and to also perhaps make a connection with solar eclipses because they were important, obviously, to Nerva.
Yes. Oh, Tona, that's been fantastic. Thank you for taking us on a journey both through time and through the skies as well. But we've been from First Nation astronomy to Albert Einstein to Rome to the Royal Mint in Perth of 2022. What a journey it's been on. Thank you very much for your time. Your book, Eclipse Chasers, is available now in all good bookshops?
In all good bookshops. I was in a bookshop the other day and I thought, there's my book.
Yeah. Must say, I really enjoyed having a look through it.
Thanks, Craig. I actually am very pleased to be on this podcast, and I have listened to most of your podcasts and enjoyed everyone. And I would like to acknowledge First Nations people of this country as the first astronomers. And while my research is in other areas of astronomy, I am always in awe of what First Nations people have been able to pass on and observe in their culture. So I want to sort of finish with that acknowledgement, and to thank the Chow Chak Wing Museum for everything that in the humanities and other parts of this university we now get to enjoy.
Thank you very much, Tina. Thank you for joining us, and thank you to our listeners. Objects Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chow Chak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the lands in which we work and to pay our respect of elders past and present.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.